I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And if you're listening to this station, I think you know it's Election Day. And a highly anticipated Election Day at that. Projections of voter turnout are high, and so are fears of voter suppression, not to mention high-stakes races and ballot issues across the state line. So what is happening so far? Laura Spencer has been hitting the polls in Missouri, scoping out the situation. She has been everywhere today, starting at like 5 a.m., and she's checking in with us now about what she's seen so far. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Gina. How are you?
I'm good. So tell me about your day so far, combing the polls, checking out what's happening in Missouri.
That's right. I started the morning at Rockhurst University Community Center, and it was cold, about 40 degrees, and I talked to some folks who had started waiting in line at 5:45. One woman said that there are about 30 people in line in front of her. And things have been kind of moving steadily. The parking lot was pretty packed here at Rockhurst this morning around 6. It seems I'm actually returned to my starting place, and things have kind of quieted down a little bit. Most people I talked to said that the wait was about 10 to 20 minutes, and then it took them about 10 to 20 minutes to complete the ballot, which in Missouri is very long. So quite a few people came prepared. They brought their notes. They brought their, you know, lists of what they were voting for. Actually, everyone I talked to was well prepared, knowing that the ballot would take them a while.
Do you have a sense of the vibe being in any way different from what you've seen covering previous elections and especially previous midterm elections?
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, I was asking people if there was a certain issue or a candidate that got them out to vote, and most people just talked about civic duty, feeling like, you know, that they needed to come out and vote. So I think there's, you know, good energy at the polls, but it does feel a little bit different. It feels like people just feel like they have this responsibility. A woman who was an African-American woman in Lee's Summit that I talked to said that her ancestors fought for the right to vote, and she felt like it was important for her to vote. Other people mentioned health care as issues. Some people talked about being upset with Democrats, and others talked about, you know, support for Republicans. There are a lot of different issues, but a lot of people just kind of upbeat and you know, happy to wait in line and feel like they've done their civic duty.
And so when people have predicted high turnout, and particularly high turnout among young voters and high turnout, interestingly, among suburban voters, suburban women in particular. Do your just casual observations bear that out so far as you've been just observing?
So far, since I started out about 6, there were more older voters, but yeah, quite a few women voters. Couples coming to vote. Now at this time, and I'm back here at Rockhurst, looks like there's some younger voters. But when I was out early this morning, it seemed like more kind of, you know, people in their 30s to 70s who are out to vote.
Any final thoughts about what you're seeing and questions that your observations are raising for you or reports that you're planning to follow up on?
So far it just seems like there's a lot of excitement and people who were ready to vote. Maybe that's kind of one of the differences this year is people talked about really not having too many surprises walking in because they had printed out the ballot or they had talked to their friends or they had read up on the issues. So most people have been very well prepared to vote.
Well, Laura Spencer, thank you.
Great. Thank you, Gina.
Laura Spencer is one of our Election Day reporters here at KCUR. She's covering the polls in Missouri. We'll be checking in with our reporters again on Up to Date. And if you encounter problems while voting, let us know. We're partnering with ProPublica's Election Land. And if there's something you want to investigate, you can tell us about it on Twitter. We are at KCURCST, and the National Reporting Project is at Election Land. Ginny Blanton, Virginia Blanton, and Max Skidmore are here now. Let's talk about the vocabulary of voting. Our guests are Max Skidmore from UMKC's Political Science Department and Virginia Blanton, a professor in the English Department. Hi, both of you. So this idea came to me because of the word voter. You know how sometimes a really common word will suddenly seem weird? Like it looks weird when you write it or say it out loud? That happened to me with the word voter, and I think that's because we did this whole series on first-time voters. I was saying it over and over again, vote, voter, And then I suddenly couldn't think of any other word it might be related to.
I think that its derivation comes from hope.
I'm the amateur here. Jenny's the professional. But I have always been interested in words. And at the moment, I'm very much interested in voters. So I hope everyone goes out and votes.
So the word vote is a kind of a weird one. Ginny, what do you have to say about the word vote?
Well, vote is a fascinating word. If you think about its etymological roots, it comes from Latin, vovere, V-O-V-E-R-E, which means to be devoted or to vow to something. And so when you think about the word devoted, vote is part of that. And when you put yourself in some kind of vowed position in relation to something, this is where it comes from. And this idea that we will vow to support a particular person or a referendum or an election, it's our stamp that we are committed to that particular thing or person.
So I like the idea of a vote being a commitment. Do you think that that terminology should instill us with a certain feeling on Election Day?
How I wish that were true. I mean, when I started thinking about votes, votive, which is an ecclesiastical term, we give votive offerings or votive candles, devotional behavior. We often think about our votes, though, as ones that we throw away, or we vote this way, even though we know the person is not going to maybe win. And so when we think about votes, I don't know that we think about them as a real vow of support.
And very often there's a dual motivation. There's a positive motivation for a particular candidate and a negative motivation hoping to get rid of another candidate.
That's
or
right.
Preclude that candidate from...
Yeah, we're being very political in terms of how can we use our vote against or as opposed to for a particular person.
So let's talk about other voting words now that we've gotten the main voting word, which would be voting... kind of established. What about poll? P-O-L-L. That's another weird one. We use it all the time, all of us.
It's a great word. It has a Dutch derivation. We think it's a borrowing from Dutch. Poll actually means head. And so over the years, poll has moved from being the counting of sheep in the 1500s, when it first came into English, to become the counting of things. And you can see how it would probably evolve into the counting of votes. But we talk about a head tax. A poll tax is literally a head tax. The interesting thing about poll, though, if you go and look at that in the Oxford English Dictionary, it has all kinds of interesting derivations in which to poll means to cut the horns off of a cow. So literally to cut the head off of something so that you're counting things that you're taking care of in agriculture. How it moves into election word, it becomes then very interesting. How do we count the people who've stood for a particular idea?
Right. And given American history, it has a sinister implication. A poll tax in the South is often thought to have meant a tax that you pay in order to get the right to vote. That wasn't it at all. You had to present evidence that you'd paid a poll tax, like a property tax, to get your license tag renewed in Missouri in order to vote. It was affiliated or associated with the vote, but it wasn't literally a voting tax. It meant a tax paid by every person, counting persons, as Jenny said.
So that is also just the idea of polls being heads, you know, like counting heads, like grade school. That's actually what polling is, kind of.
That's right. And then so it's interesting how we move from this idea of counting things or counting people, counting objects, to now it's moved now into how do you count an opinion? So it's become much more figurative, moving from a physical object.
How do you count expectations?
That's right. So now we talk about the polls in terms of things that are going to tell us what will happen in an election that's coming.
Right. How do you infer from that what the future will be? That is
super interesting. So we're talking about voting vocabulary. We've talked about voting and polling. What about tally? All of these words sound, we use them all the time. They sound so weird when you stop and say, like, what's that word? Tally.
I'm so glad you mentioned tally right after poll, because they're related in the sense of a tally is literally a mark on a stick in which we count things. So once again, we're counting. The first usage of the word tally in this particular way was in 1189 in terms of tallying a debt or a payment. And so you would take a wooden stick and you would notch in the side of this. And so the ancient sort of way of making an accounting record. And you can see just by imagining how tallying then becomes part of making a mark in some kind of systemic way, whether that's on a chalkboard or now we have it in computerized systems that help us keep count of larger and larger and larger numbers.
Right. Or in the American popular culture, the another sinister implication, notches on the gun of the people you've shot.
That's so weird.
Yes.
These tally sounds like such a happy word.
It really is. I mean, and it should be. What's interesting is that the first sort of usage in related to voting, and I love this about election words, so much of what happens in the U.S. are related to the late 1700s into the 1800s. And so the first usage was in the English Dialectical Dictionary, and in 1774 was the first time we used tally in the kind of way related to an election.
So tally, vote, poll. Those are the ones we've talked about so far. And if you have a voting word that intrigues you as you're listening to people talking about voting and elections all day today, you can tweet those to us. We are at KCURCST. Let's talk about swing, as in swing vote, swing state, swing district. Max?
Swing, did you say?
Swing
vote. You swing from one side to the other side, and that's taken on coloration literally today in terms of red states, blue states, and purple states in the middle, one that can swing back from red to blue. And the colors themselves are very modern. We didn't have color television to any great extent until the elections of 1976. And at those elections, those programs were indiscriminate with regard to colors. Each station might be consistent in its use of color, but they weren't consistent among stations. And in the election of 2000, the broadcasters agreed to standardize their reporting. Red states became Republican. Democratic states became blue.
That was that recent?
Mm-hmm.
That's very bizarre. It feels...
Yes.
Eternal,
mm-hmm.
This talk of red states and blue states. And swing state, is that so? That's fairly recent terminology as well?
I don't remember hearing it for more than a few decades anyway, but it I think gradually crept into the vocabulary without much thought. Jenny, do you have any?
No, I'm sorry. I didn't look up that particular phrase for swing, but I am interested in the way that swing states are being used as a figurative reference to people's ability to shift, right?
Yes.
This is what a swing does. And so as opposed to permanence, there's this idea that you might be able to sway something.
Mm-hmm.
And so that imagery of a swing state or a swing vote is really kind of fascinating.
That's right. You have a swing state populated by swing voters, those who change their minds and... there are various presuppositions. They talk about the last-minute swing vote, which probably is not likely to go to the status quo. You don't wait until the last minute to decide to support the status quo as much as you would to support a change in the status quo. So the swing vote is likely to come.
Interesting. So people get brave, like I wouldn't say brave, but people get risky at the last minute more than they plan a calculated, what might be perceived as some kind of calculated risk?
Yes.
Huh. Swing is a really commonplace word that is used in a particular way when we talk about elections and voting. And another one of those is to run, as in to run for office. And the image that you get there, if you take it literally, like Amelia Bedelia style, is pretty funny. What is the history of talking about running for office?
I'm associating that with, I think it was Theodore Roosevelt who said, "My hat is in the ring." Meant that he is running for office. You're filing, you're running, you're taking action to achieve a political goal.
Well, if you think about some of the related words like race, it is a race. Mm-hmm. This is a contest in which we have two or more people who are competing. And this leads directly to that one of your favorite phrases, the front runner, right? The one who is in the lead the entire time. And so when we talk about political elections, we do this very much in the sort of language of contest and sport.
And also in candidate selection, a dark horse.
That's right.
A dark horse is one who wasn't considered until late in the process, and suddenly, like James K. Polk, became the nominee.
With a word like run, that's the language of a contest. But what about the language of military? We'll start with a particular word, but then there is sort of a broader language code around sort of military terminology and the pitting of one side against another. Let's start with campaign, because that, although that was not originally a military word either, it was that before it was a political word.
That's right. Campaign, you know, in the earliest military usages, sort of an army in the field, doing actual maneuvers, engaged in an operation. This is 1656 when we have that military usage. We don't have it in election usage until about 1809. But this idea that there is a group, our side against your side, this contest in which we are now going to have some kind of military force, whatever that might mean, we're going to use all arms, all hands on deck. We're going to go after our particular, and here's another word, platform, in order to push for the best candidate. And candidate actually comes from that military background that you're talking about.
But can I talk about campaign a little bit
more?
Oh,
sure. I'm sorry. I'm jumping ahead.
the meaning of campaign that existed before that was even a military word is sort of a reference to, like, the countryside. And the idea of a campaign having a geographic reference, like the idea of a large tract of open land being sort of grounds for a campaign, the idea that you have either a state or a county or a city or a nation that you are at one point would have had to literally traverse to get the word out.
That's right. And some people know this word in relation to French campagne, right? You know, into the countryside. And this idea of a geographical space is very much imbued in that word.
So now it took on campaign a military sense, and then it took on from there a political sense. And that's not the only word, you know, in today in the media. I'm not going to talk about the media like I'm not part of it, but you have candidates sparring and candidates in their war chests, which is often how campaign funds are described. You know, it is a pretty dark way of looking at elections, though maybe fair when you think about divisiveness and all the talk about divisiveness.
Yes, and if you don't think adequately before you say something, you're shooting from the hip without taking adequate aim, so your shot may go awry or astray.
That's right, or shot over the bow. We're going to start in the first one, right? This idea of candidate, candidati, comes from the Roman Imperial Army, that they were the ones who were dressed in white, these formal tunics, and they would be the imperial bodyguards. So from the very beginning, they would be selected. They'd be the elect who would be selected to preserve the state, as it were.
And it has influenced the academy as well, your candidates for degrees.
That's right.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about Election Day words, words we use all the time, but especially today, even though we might not really know where they come from. So where do they come from? My guests to answer that question are Virginia Blanton and Max Skidmore. They're both with me from UMKC. Virginia is in the English department and Max is in the political science department. Hi again, you two.
Hello. Good morning.
So before we go any further, the weirdest of all voting vocab words, gerrymander. Who is Jerry? Please tell me he's some guy.
He was definitely some guy. Albridge Gerry. He was governor of,
Massachusetts.
Massachusetts. And I knew it was a New England state. And he drew, he had occasion to draw up an electoral district in order to include the votes he wanted and exclude the votes he wanted not to be there. And it came out in such a strange shape. There is a little amphibian called a salamander, but there's also a mythological creature, a dragon-like thing called a salamander. And a cartoonist saw the shape of that and put wings and claws on it and so forth and made it a gerrymander, and the name has stuck.
Wow. Are there other instances of political cartoonists or political satire yielding a commonplace term that...
I believe Thomas Nast was the one who came out with the elephant and the donkey. Thomas Nast, a political cartoonist in New York at the latter part of the 19th century.
Huh. Okay, but gerrymander Jerry is a real guy.
Yes.
Is Jerry the same, is this the same Jerry who Jerry rigs things?
No, that's Jerry built or jury rigged. J-U-R-Y.
Okay, so not the same right. at all. Any other thoughts about gerrymander, Virginia? I know this is not one that goes back to Old English, which would be more your expertise.
That's right. No, the interesting thing is when we have coinages, and really this is a coinage where you take one word and or a name and put them together to make something. And I really love that this has this etymology that's really linked to a particular time and place and that it had mm-hmm. this connection to a political cartoonist. So I believe this happened around 1812, if anybody's really interested in the dating of this.
And there's another very ubiquitous example, the suffix gate. Any scandal, no matter how minor, becomes gate, Korea gate.
Anything.
And it trivializes the notion of political scandals, trivializes the notion of Watergate, from which it came, the Watergate apartments in Washington, D.C. And the,
yeah, there are baby gates in my house, and sometimes right. I kind of chuckle, being like,
right.
it's baby gate.
What scandal led to that?
So gerrymander has this visual image, it turns out, of the shape of an odd mythological mm-hmm. creature mm-hmm. being the shape of a voting district, essentially.
Yes.
What about some other visual imagery sort of terms, like bellwether?
A bellwether state is one. Missouri was one for some time, one that votes in with the winners. And therefore can, popular wisdom assumes that it can be taken as an indication of the way the country is going to go. If the state goes this way and it's a bellwether, then the country will follow the state. And there were two prominent states of that sort. As Maine goes, so goes the nation was the original comment. And then when Franklin Roosevelt carried every state in the country in 1936 except Maine and Vermont. Some wags said, as Maine goes, so goes Vermont.
There's this also whole history of what was once a bellwether state suddenly no longer being one and vice versa. Is that how have you observed that as a political science professor, that something's a bellwether till it isn't?
That's correct. Missouri, throughout much of its existence, was a democratic state. It had been a slave state. It was not a part of the Confederacy, but it was considered semi-Southern. And the Democratic Party was strong in the state for many years. And in common with the South, it has become much more Republican after the Civil Rights Act and so forth. But it's still less so than most of the southern states. And It is a swing state still, even though basically it has performed as a red state in recent decades.
You know, we have a caller who I don't have time to go to, but our caller is informing us that bellwether, the origin of that word, is actually, again, according to our caller, a male goat who leads other goats through the mountains.
Hmm.
I guess maybe the goat would have had a bell.
Makes sense. I wish I had looked this one up myself, because now I want to know.
Yes.
So bandwagon. Bandwagon is another one that has a definite image.
It does have. You jump on the bandwagon. You join the movement. And you can, you can't visualize sound, but you can imagine the sound as well as the visual aspect of it. And it's uncomfortably similar to the wagon, which you fall off of if you begin to drink if you're an alcoholic. So.
That's right. You know, the first person to use the term bandwagon was P.T. Barnum, which makes a lot mm-hmm. of sense in terms of the circus. And he did that in 1855, but it wasn't until 1893 in the Congressional Record it started to be used as a political term that we now talk about politicians being on a bandwagon or voters getting on the bandwagon.
What was going on in the election that inspired that term to be used? Just regular stuff? Because, you know, interestingly, I think a lot of these words, we expect there to be some moment that's extraordinary that gives rise to them. But actually, if you think about what makes a word useful, it's when you're like, that's exactly what this thing is that's happening all the time. And there's finally a word that gets at it. And so bandwagon could be something like that.
It could be. Max, do you happen to know?
It could be. Modern campaigning actually began in the election of 1840 when William Henry Harrison, the short-lived one-month president, he died in office after a month, campaigned on no issues, but the Whigs that year did pioneer the practice of bandwagons, literally, and campfires and stump speeches and flag waving and providing free drinks and all that.
Sure.
And it now has entered into the 30s, I think, in terms of propaganda analysis, the bandwagon effect. In other words, there is a peer pressure from the majority. When everyone is jumping on the bandwagon, you're expected to jump on also, or at least you're encouraged to, and you may have to require a great deal of internal strength to avoid going with the majority. So.
Right now, we talk so much about silos, mm-hmm. and it's funny that you talk about the majority being what holds sway when this term mm-hmm. first gets used. It seems like right now the thing that holds sway is often people's own sort of personal, like the majority in their own networks rather than the majority mm-hmm. out there.
Right. And I believe that's a rather new usage also. And previously, you
silo.
Would say compartmentalized, which was actually more descriptive, I think, than silos. I think of farms and silos being completely, they are compartmentalized, but they're also very restricted and narrow.
But I guess
that's appropriate also.
But silos stand alone, right?
Yes.
So this idea mm-hmm. that you can stand against a tide or mm-hmm. On your own erect and able to maintain your opinion and your views. Mm-hmm. I think that's really interesting because this becomes language of emotion, mm-hmm. right? Bandwagons or being part of, especially with bands playing, when music and the hype of a given mm-hmm. A stump speech, for instance, would encourage people to jump forward and to be excited. Yeah. The idea of the silo, I'm going to resist that kind of emotional mm-hmm. appeal, right? So there's something going on there in the way that we think about people's sensory responses in
but
elections.
It suggests a kind of mental mixed metaphor of a band a band playing in a silo.
That's right.
But it seems to be the opposite of the conventional wisdom, which is supposedly widespread and so forth. And that was a term that wasn't a wasn't immediately its meaning wasn't immediately evident until it was explained. John Kenneth Galbraith coined it in 1950.
Which term are we talking about now?
The conventional wisdom.
Gotcha.
That's the assumption, the general assumption that people have, which may be conventional and it may even be wise, but isn't always. It was actually a coinage in the affluent society. And he had a whole chapter explaining what he meant by it, and it has entered into the vocabulary not only of politics but of general popular English usage.
So we are talking about just very common voting terminology that has oftentimes really interesting backstory to contextualize it and help us understand what we are doing today, maybe through another lens. So let's look at speaking of very common words, party and party line. And we'll start just with party. Why does our party affiliation, politically speaking, why does that have the same name as what we do on birthdays with hats and candles and things?
Well, the first vice president to succeed to the presidency following the death of a president was John Tyler, who succeeded the unfortunate William Henry Harrison, whom I mentioned earlier. And he had been a Democrat, but he broke with Andrew Jackson and ran on the Whig ticket. But he wasn't really a Whig, and when he succeeded to the presidency, he began to veto Whig measures, and the Whigs read him out of the party. And the Democrats didn't want him back either, and he only served one term. He didn't get renominated, and he said, this is the first time I've heard it used in that way, he said, well, they say I'm a president without a party, but I'll show them. I'll throw a big party. And he invited everyone to the White House and so forth. The founders spoke of it, but didn't use the term party. They used the term faction, and they didn't like it. They tended to criticize the notion. Their emphasis was on the public good. And to them, a faction or a party represented narrow interests that appeal to a certain group as opposed to other groups. And how it morphed from faction into party, I don't know. But it does appear quite evident by experience through the centuries that democracies don't work well without parties. Where the parties are strong, they tend to work much better, even though they still have a bad reputation for obvious reasons.
But now when people talk about factions, they're usually talking about the splintering of parties, mm-hmm. not the existence of them, which is
right.
somewhat
ironic.
The standard or given mm-hmm. of American politics today mm-hmm. is having parties that when they were first created, those mm-hmm. were factions.
Mm-hmm.
That was just a splintering of the whole.
That's right.
What about then party line? I guess that's just the way a ballot appears.
A political program becomes the party's line. There's a political platform Jenny mentioned earlier, and that's adopted by the convention that nominates a candidate at the presidential level anyway. And that use of line is an interesting I'd never looked into it, and I never thought about it until you brought it up, but you're right.
I've never been sure whether it's a line as in mm-hmm. you're sort of repeating someone else's mm-hmm. line like in a script or something like that, mm-hmm. or if it's line as in on the ballot, these mm-hmm. options would appear in a line.
I suspect it's the former. But
well, I think it's become both. Mm-hmm. The first usage of this in U.S. politics was 1837, the idea of a policy officially adopted by the political party, mm-hmm. but also a division in matters of policy that separated parties. So the mm-hmm. line is the division between mm-hmm. two mm-hmm. sets of ideologies.
Almost territorial again.
That's
geographic.
Right. That's mm-hmm. right. We're setting things apart. And again, mm-hmm. that's part of being a party is that it's a smaller piece of a whole.
Ginny, what about suffrage? I think that's sort of more of a voting history kind of word, but nonetheless a weird one and one that people mix up with something that it sounds like.
That's right. Well, we know about suffragettes, but I don't think many of us realize where that term comes from. And it's actually a medieval term. It comes from Latin, the suffragium, which is an intercessory prayer. And so this idea is the prayers for the dead would be petitions that you would put forward. And over time, that word suffrage, by the 1535 or so, 1350s, the idea of you have a collective body of persons who want to petition in a particular direction, so that by 1665, we start to have this idea of casting a vote. And by in the U.S., 1789, which is an important constitutional moment, the right or privilege of voting is how it's then named. And so, again, it's about a petition.
You know, you mentioned earlier that to vote came from a Latin root, which had to do with like a vow or a commitment or almost a wish. I think of maybe like the only word I can think of that kind of sounds similar would be votive, like a votive candle.
That's right.
And then suffrage, you're talking about sort of religious underpinnings to that word too, like an appeal to the dead.
That's right. There are in many of these election words some ecclesiastical background. A precinct used to be the ecclesiastical area in which a church or area was held. A bishop would be one of the major jurisdictional or legal people. And so some of this language is literally coming out of the medieval past in terms of its ecclesiastical origins.
Well, suffrage also connotes permission. By the time of the 17th century, at least, it made it into the King James Bible as in, suffer the little children to come unto me, for such is the kingdom of heaven. And
so it's permission to enter.
Yes, it's language that tends, I think, to frighten little children today if they hear it in Sunday school or something.
But the right to vote as permission to enter, that's what today we would call that inclusion.
Right. But the term suffragette, many feminists reject because it's a diminutive, and as such, it reduces their efforts to of the little woman or something.
That's right. Yeah. So ETTE means little female thing.
You guys, we've got to skedaddle, but I have one more word that we very quickly must address, and that is ballot.
A ballot comes from the French word for ball, a small ball that you would drop in to indicate your vote. You would drop it in an urn or a box, and now then became a piece of paper.
It can, in some situations, take the form of a black ball.
That's right.
And you cast your ballot. That's another word.
That's up.
Well, think about that today when you cast your ballot. Max Skidmore, Virginia Blanton, thank you so much.
Great to see you, Gina.
Max is UMKC, from UMKC's Political Science Department. Ginny is from the English Department. She is a medievalist who knows Old English. They've been helping us understand the language we use about voting. I'm Gina Kaufman, KCUR's Central Standard. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we are going to take a short Election Day breather before we pick back up with that coverage just a few short minutes from now. Maybe you are anxious about results, worried about the outcome, but right now, let's tap into something that puts us in touch with our humanity and maybe even our sanity. Creativity, self-expression. November is National Novel Writing Month, affectionately known as NaNoWriMo. So let's take a deep breath and talk about it. It's a big project encouraging amateurs and professionals alike to crank out a novel in 1 month's time. People in our area are participating right along with people all over the country. So that is something that unites us this election day. Right, David Burns?
Absolutely.
David is with us from the Mid-Continent Public Library's Woodneath branch, where people are working diligently on their novels right now. David, what's inspiring people to do this?
Well, as you mentioned, it gives people an opportunity to share their creativity, just to speak their voice. Part of what we do at Woodneath is we have our Story Center, which helps people tell their story. That's kind of our base mission. And what better way than to give someone an opportunity to really focus in and just write out a novel for a month?
You are a writer yourself, is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
Have you tried this?
I have. I am not as successful as other individuals.
Why
not? The goal is 50,000 words in a month, and I am just too much of an editor to do this. So I think the most I've ever successfully done is about 11,000 because I keep going back and fixing the words, which is not the way to do it.
So this is about moving forward, not looking back.
It is. It's about just kind of pedal to the metal going forward.
What do you notice just about the spirit of people coming together to write? Because writing is known for being such a solitary thing.
Writing is a very solitary activity. And I think what something like this does is gives people a chance to kind of come out of their solitary worlds and support each other and see other people that are doing a similar thing and really start to build some community around that. I've seen a lot of folks connect at NaNoWriMo and then build relationships further on throughout the year, which is great.
Well, Marian Rakestraw is with us from Liberty, and her motivation for doing NaNoWriMo, interestingly enough, doesn't have to do with getting published or taking her writing career to the next level, per se. It is primarily about something else, and David just hinted at it. Marian, hello.
Hi.
What's your story? What got you interested in NaNoWriMo, National Novel Writing Month?
Well, I've been doing NaNoWriMo since 2012, and unlike Dave, I write 50,000 words every year. And I originally got involved with NaNoWriMo. I'd heard of it before, interestingly enough, on National Public Radio originally. And
what was going on in your life when you heard this?
Well, I had originally heard this many years previously, and I was one of those one-day writers. One day I'm going to write a novel. Someday I'm going to do this. But, of course, you don't. You don't get it written. And in 2011, my family moved to Topeka. And in 2012, I thought, I want to meet some people in this town. I want to branch out and find my tribe. So Topeka has a very energetic writing group centered around its great library there. And NaNoWriMo is centered there. So I joined National Novel Writing Month. Probably mid-October I signed up. And that year, I wrote a 50,000-word novel, and I met some wonderful people. And really, National Novel Writing Month, if you go to events associated with it, it's kind of like a 30-day party that results in everybody there getting a book. So you can't fail.
The idea that you can be a writer socially, I have hinted at that, but that is so counterintuitive.
It is.
The idea being that people kind of have drilled into them, like, stay home and write your book. Mm-hmm. Don't go out. Don't get distracted. Do you the events themselves aren't distracted? Because you can't possibly be writing while you're hanging out.
Yes,
or can you?
I can.
Okay, tell me about it.
And I agree that writing is a really solitary activity. So much of it takes place inside your own head with your own ideas. But the magic of going to like a write-in, there's one tonight at the Woodneath Library at 6 o'clock, and I'll be there, is that other people are there and they're also writing. And even though you're sitting next to someone and you're not talking to them per se, you're both engaged in the same activity and you feed off each other's creativity. And I think you make more words faster if other people are writing next to you. And then you take breaks every 15 or 20 minutes and chat a bit. Like if I'm having a terrible problem in my book, I have written my characters into a corner and I just don't know what to do with them now. I can turn to the person next to me and say, oh, it's awful. The buildings are on fire and there's alien sea bass attacking them and I don't know how to get out of this. What can I do? And they'll help me figure out a solution to that and move forward.
So they don't look at you and go, I'm writing.
not during the breaks. They run something called word sprints where they'll set a timer for 15 or 20 minutes. And you write as many words as you can in that 15 or 20 minutes. And then you compare, how many words did you write? I wrote this many. And there are prizes for people who write the most words. You could win a something. You know.
So you do this in search, essentially, of community. I mean, obviously, you like to write, and
sure.
You want to write books, and you do write books.
I do.
But searching for community this way, have you, you've done that in more than one town, in one more than one community?
I have, and
can you tell us about that?
Sure. In the community of NaNoWriMo, there's a physical community of it, and there's kind of an ephemeral electronic community of it. There are, on the NaNoWriMo website, there are forums. You join a region. There, Kansas City has its own region, and you can talk to people there. Instagram has a huge NaNoWriMo community. Twitter has a huge NaNoWriMo community. So you can connect with people electronically and find your people there. And then there's the official write-ins. People do just general meetups. They'll say, hey, I'm going to be in this coffee shop from these hours. See you there. I've met people in Starbucks and written, you know, and so forth all over the place. And I have 7 novels out of it. And writing 7 novels has taught me how to write a novel. I think if the first one I wrote was terrible, it was so bad. It dazzles even me how bad it really is.
But dazzlingly bad.
It's dazzlingly bad. But if I had not joined NaNoWriMo, I would, one, still be a someday writer. I wouldn't have a novel. Or if I had managed to work my way through that first novel, I would have written one really bad novel, instead of which by now, this is a novel number 8 going on by now.
So there's like, I'm going to botch a Mark Twain quote, but the whole, the master has failed more times than the amateur has tried.
Sure. And now by this many novels in, I understand the structure of what I'm writing better and how to build a better sentence, how to build a better paragraph, how characters work. So in a way, it's made me a better writer and certainly a more prolific one.
David, talk to me about this. Just the exercise of completing the process for a first time and being given some parameters for getting it done.
Absolutely. Well, I think parameters are very important when you set out to partake in a project like this. Writing a novel, yes.
Any project that takes a really long time.
Yes, you need some kind of parameter and some kind of goals. And, you know, as Marion was kind of hinting at, you start just by taking that first step and seeing what you can put out there. And the more you continue doing this, the more you participate in these different write-ins and those sort of things. I think you learn what your parameters are and your goals, and the community can also help guide those too. A 50,000-word novel is a very large thing to try to tackle in a month. But what a lot of people do, which I think is a very brilliant approach, is they take the previous month and kind of start to outline what they're going to write about. Because sitting down and writing just 50,000 words, although that's the dream, is not always very successful. And so having some kind of roadmap as far as where you're trying to go is great. And, you know, as Marion was saying, she and I know other people have learned how to do that. And so they will take October prepping for their NaNoWriMo novel. And then once it's done, they will spend the time editing and go on from there.
Marion, do you see a lot of different techniques in this community?
I do. In like lots of communities, NaNoWriMo has its own vocabulary. And the two big types of people you see are called pantsers and planners, right?
I'm not
pantsers? I'm obviously a pantser. I write by the seat of my pants.
Oh.
So planners will sit down and, you know, write a synopsis of every chapter that's going to happen, and they have book Bibles and all the character sketches, and they know what their character's star sign is and the name of their dog. And then there's me. I know what I'm writing, and I know how it starts, maybe the first 3 chapters, and I know where I want to go, but the middle is an adventure. And I love that process of discovery and surprise. And both ways work. Every way works. I encourage people to find that method that works for them and stick to it, and don't listen to other people tell you how to write your book. This is your book. Go write it your way.
What do you think it is that has changed in your life because of NaNoWriMo, National Novel Writing Month?
Well, it's made me a writer, for starters. I'm confident now in my own abilities. And NaNoWriMo says the world needs your story. And I think I've started to believe that the world does need my story. And I can make something that is worth having in the world. Certainly, it has given me, like I said, friends and people who speak my language and are interested in what I'm interested in. And like I said, if I can write 50,000 words in November, every November, what can I not do? Practically nothing.
So this is the intellectual marathon.
It is.
David Burns, any tips for people who might want to get in on this 6 days late? Or is it just too late?
Oh, I don't think it's ever quite too late. We have, as Marion suggested, we have several write-ins scheduled throughout MidContinent Public Library, Monday nights at our Parkville branch, Tuesdays at Woodneath, and Wednesdays even at Midwest Genealogy Center. They're getting in on the action this year. And even if it's a matter of just jumping in for a little bit, we do have some wrap-up parties at the end of the time just to celebrate.
Well, David Burns with us from the Woodneath branch of the Midcontinent Public Library. Marion Rakestraw, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
There are tons of resources available. NaNoWriMo.com is also out there, and you can ask about support groups all over the place. That is a wrap for today's show. We've got more live election coverage coming right up with reporters checking in on Up to Date. And of course, we'll be providing extensive results coverage this evening starting at 7. We'll have local updates from KCUR and national updates from NPR. And our conversation about voting terminology will be available online later today in case you missed it. KCUR.org/Central Standard. Tomorrow, we'll be hearing from a first-time voter about how it went, and you can tell us how it went for you, too. That's tomorrow at 10 on Central Standard. Today's show was produced by Melody Rowell, Chris Young, Sylvia Maria Gross, and intern Sophia Gillespie. I'm Gina Kaufman. Happy voting, everyone.